Welcome to Who Are You, a CSI podcast. I'm Raven, and I've seen CSI through and through around 3 to 4 times.
And I'm Nick, and these are my first time experiencing these episodes.
And today we are reviewing Season 3, Episode 15, Lady Heather's Box. Original air date is February 13th, 2003. Director is Richard J. Lewis. Writers are Anthony E. Zeiger, Carol Mendelson, and Andrew Lipsitz. And we begin this, as Nick found out, longer than usual episode.
Yeah, maybe take a moment. This is, I guess, the first ever 90-minute episode.
First ever 90-minute episode of CSI.
But apparently this is like this thing that they were doing called supersized episodes, probably in and around Sweeps Week, which is like a big thing for old school format television that probably doesn't exist anymore. But I looked at the questions like on a wiki or IMDb or something afterwards. And they said this was in response to NBC doing that and being very successful. And so I guess this is the first time, and it was highly successful because the show was pretty well liked. So I don't know. And it's certainly not a bad episode, and it maybe had a big lift. I wonder if this show's like overall viewership, maybe back in the day. Yeah. So kind of fun, but it is a very Vegas-y episode.
Yeah. We start this episode with shots of the Vegas Strip. So Nick, what is our Vegas score for today's episode?
Well, as our current Vegas score has a cap, we blew past this cap aggressively.
Yeah.
And really was that made me realize like how long this episode was. I didn't pay attention to the tracker while watching it.
And they really relied on scenes of the Vegas Strip in between scenes. Like there was a lot of like, we're in this scene. Okay. Shot of the Vegas Strip. Now we're in like the next scene. Like they relied on that quite heavily throughout this episode.
Well, there's a few things. So there's a lot of weirdness that happens. So overall, it's actually 15 different shots of the Vegas Strip.
Wow.
Over 36 seconds.
Oh my goodness.
You can fit a whole commercial in there and then some. The most, it would be like 80 something if you added them all up. But we top out at 55 because it's LV.
LV.
And so this gets the LV. It's the second time only ever for us to have an LV.
Okay.
A maxed out score. I think that like if you think of 2/3 of the score, we might not be at a max score. So, but we'd be very close. It'd be like a 53.
Yeah.
But it's also very different because the when they put scenes in is different and or different storylines.
Yes.
But there's also some very cool about the way they use these scenes to sort of tell one of the plot lines about it being rainy.
Yes.
Right. And that had impact on some of these stories.
Yep.
And so using those, and I think that's one of the reasons we had so many shots. So if that storyline was part of a episode with maybe less in it, I think you would still hit that 55. Without a problem. So yeah, I'm giving it my even though it's a long episode, I think it blew past it by more than enough. No penalties here. You get the LV stamp on this episode. Definitely a lot of scenes of Vegas, a very risque episode, but not like a lot of gambling subplots or something, which is something we often consider. But I think some of the other sort of nightlife parts of Vegas are very much called out. So it feels very Vegas-y too. And so I think it's very deserving of that. But yeah, Def blowing away, full LV score today.
It makes sense to me. So we go from the Vegas Strip to people having to go through a security check to get into like what we assume is like a club or some sort of event. And of course, I feel like this sets the scene for like one of the storylines. A woman is getting scanned.
Yep.
And the guard scans her front and it beeps like, right in her area, and she's like, "Well, my kitty peers. Do you want to see?" And I was like, and again, we had a long discussion in the last episode about like they could say semen, but then they were weird about other things they wouldn't say. And this was definitely another like, "Oh, right, like you're not gonna say what is actually pierced." Fair, gotcha, CSI.
Said, I guess I don't know where the piercing is, but
this is true.
I will say, I hope he said yes because
I mean. Professionally, he should say yes.
Yeah, or, that's what I'm saying. Who knows what's in there?
Professionally, he should call in a female coworker and have the female coworker check.
I mean, yeah. Well, that gets fuzzy anyways because, like, gender itself does not indicate.
I know, but but I'm just saying.
But it, I mean, certainly the person was offering.
She was.
Don't necessarily need to try to gender or sex match or whatever it is in that situation. But yeah, the point is, don't let people smuggle drugs or weapons in their underwear.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah. So she was,
I mean, many people at this club for reasons were wearing very little.
Yes. Yeah. So we then go inside of this event. It is a foam party. I had to put down in my notes that's just gross. Like, it's gross.
Yeah. That was
unhygienic. It's bad for a while. It was gross. I mean, they still do it. I was at a resort recently that they had a foam party, and I was like, no, thank you. Like, I am going nowhere near that. So, you know, there's a lot of making out and people dancing on one another and like hints of more
like foam in their face. Like, that can't be.
Yeah.
That can't be attractive.
Gross. And
tastes like dung.
Through this debauchery, a woman emerges from the foam screaming, and not in a happy yay screaming way, in a
blood curdling
scream. We're then with Jim Brass, he's with the body. The foam is gone. They're at the bottom of this like pool sort of setup. Grissom walks down. We learn that the victim is.
Do you think this is the exact same in-ground pool that's featured?
Probably.
In Lady Heather's. Yes. And they just reskinned the set.
Almost most definitely.
I kept looking. I kept thinking about that later.
It is almost most definitely the exact same one. We learn the victim is Trey Buckman. He has a puncture wound on his neck, which we will return to, my friends. But before,
the vampire with a broken tooth.
Yes, exactly. This is the vampire episode that I promised.
Yuna Fang.
Yeah. We go to credits. We then have Warwick and Sarah arriving on scene. We gotta learn that Warwick is a partier, or at least like very well knows the party scene. He's naming off like an event every single night that you can go to in that Vegas. Tracks.
That's his character so far.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying it's out of character. I'm just, you know, we're adding some layers here. Jim Brass is talking to the party organizer. Jim Brass wants the VIP list. Grissom and team are down in this little pool area, and Grissom is noting that there's seminal fluid everywhere. They also note that, I think Warwick is the one who pointed out at first, or maybe it's Grissom, that the foam smells like strawberries, which will come up several times later in this episode. We then learn from Jim Brass that the victim had a hotel room at the Sphere, so Warwick and Sarah are there. Warwick finds a long black hair, which, having seen the victim, not the victim's hair. So they're like, okay, like somebody else was in this room, most likely a woman. Catherine is then at her daughter's play. Eddie arrives. They have a tiff of sorts. Eddie interrupts the play. Lindsay runs off.
It's a very, like, I don't know, challenging. Like, it's a great job of giving that feeling of uncomfortable fighting parents.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, this is definitely not a peaceful co-parenting situation, right? Like, this is a very tense co-parenting situation.
Even, like, the way that they each sort of respond, whether it's aggressiveness or it's passive aggressiveness, whether it's, you know, like, or later on, the way they interact with Lindsay, it really shows how different of a parent these two people are.
Yes, very much so. So then Catherine and Eddie are with Lindsay in the hallway. Catherine's trying to defuse the situation. I mean, she's taking accountability, but she's trying to defuse and say like, oh, it's just a play, don't worry about it. But Lindsay not really buying into that. She wants to go home, but she wants to go home with Eddie. So Catherine agrees. Then we
other than plot, they give no reason why this might be.
No, because he's the one technically who interrupted the play. Like, he's the one that, like, stood up and said something.
Yeah.
So, like, if she should be, from first appearances, if she's mad at anybody, she should be mad at her dad and not mad at Catherine. Yeah. But that doesn't seem to be the case here. Grissom is then with Doc Robbins. We learn that the victim's talk screen was clean. The neck wound was probably lethal. I'm just gonna note that.
Probably. I mean,
probably lethal.
I don't know that we ever really, truly, fully get an answer to the level of contribution of the neck wound or the other thing, which will.
No, I don't think we do.
Which will, but I think that certainly the combination of those two. But I think you're supposed to believe that this person was, as I like to use this phrase a lot in the show, was going to die anyways.
Yeah, it was probably going to die anyways.
Probably unconscious. not to jump ahead too much. You know, yeah. What happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so weird. They don't spend too much. They talk about it. They don't get into the details because, spoiler alert, they're kind of going to just get over this neck wound real fast, despite spending a ton of time on it in the next few minutes.
Yes. They also note on the body this other little raised area. So they're wondering, is that a spider bite? Is that this? They're gonna investigate this a little bit.
I was
further. Thinking
spider bite. That's what that was my guess. I don't know. It's like
when we learn what it is, I'm like, really? Mm. But I don't know enough about the subject to really comment, to be honest.
Yeah, without any they don't provide the specific information that would probably make you understand whether this was nominal or not. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it does seem like a bit of a reaction to that site.
Yes.
For what was done based on how common of an human activity it is.
Yes. So we'll get there. Before we do, Grissom is inspecting a thong. Work walks in. I had to note this because I was like, Nick will find this funny. He's like, Work goes to touch something, and Grissom is like, gloves.
Yeah.
Like, put gloves on. And I was like, Grissom, you've been like the worst offender in the show so far of the no glove trope. But
I did stop to think, obviously they use gloves, they collect stuff, it's all laid out. And I guess, you know, they handle evidence all the time without gloves, kind of back in the station, older evidence. Once it's been processed, you know, and they're not looking to use it to collect fingerprints or DNA or anything like that. But I would think that Work would, it's actually quite reasonable. It's quite the faux pas. The number of times these people have to tell each other to put gloves on, it's too high.
It's too high.
You're PSI level 3.
Get your procedures in better order here, CSIs. Yeah. He gloves up. They're going through different items that were collected from the foam party and testing for blood. Grissom then ends up holding up a stiletto, which once sprayed, that tests for blood. We're then with Jim Brass. He's in the rain escorting out a VIP. We then have Grissom with a lineup of women, and he's letting him know, hey, I'm the prince. I'm trying to find my Cinderella. We're gonna put this shoe on each one of you and see if the shoe fits. So we get a little montage of that. And then the quote unquote Cinderella, I do have her in my notes as Cinderella for the rest, yes. for the short while she's in the episode, is Nick and I's, because we've already discussed this. First, spot the guest star. So Cinderella is a one Elizabeth Berkeley who, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I imagine we both know her primarily as Jessie from Saved by the Bell.
Jessie Spano.
Because that was definitely a TV show of our childhood.
Yeah, I mean, that's really all I know her from. She's certainly in other stuff. Very famously in the movie Showgirls, mm-hmm. Which this is giving real Showgirls vibes, which I have not seen, which is almost shocking because both of the age I was when the movie came out, but also because it's just in the zeitgeist of American culture.
It is.
That most people who didn't see it when it was avant-garde saw it eventually. Including PG-13 versions that played on Turner Network.
Yeah.
Something, you know, I mean, I don't know. Hopefully the residuals from that show. They did do a Get Back Together, reunion thing.
Oh, they did. You're right. I never watched that.
Probably got a little money for that, but I imagine. But this feels really like the kind of thing you did to put someone in a trailer. Or it gets very salacious later on without jumping too far.
The very next scene, it gets salacious. Yeah, yeah. So we'll be there in just a moment.
I do have a thought on this Cinderella moment, which was that at the time I was like, you know how many people wear the same size shoes?
Right. You know I wear a very common size shoe. So
yeah, how incriminating are you thinking of finding a shoe? And you've just gathered up all the club regulars that you can find. And there are way more people at that club, but actually in the second watch through they said it was size 10 double A, which sounds really large and specialized, so it actually might be that they covered their bases on how important a match might be.
Yeah,
they just didn't call it out for the audience.
We're then in our what will become a salacious scene with Jim Brass and Cinderella. She is claiming that she left the shoe behind because the heel broke. She never saw blood on it. You know, like, this was not a concern of her. We learn that she had a relationship, quote unquote, with the victim. She then, and she's been talking seductively and kind of eyeing Jim Brass seductively this whole time. She gets up, she sits down, sits on the table, and then puts her leg up in a fatal attraction.
Yeah, yeah. That
way, like, that is that is what I think they're supposed to be calling out here, is that very famous scene in Fatal Attraction. Grissom interrupts, takes a DNA sample from her, takes it from her hair, only to set up the scene or the moment where Jim Brass can confirm that she's not a natural blonde because of what he has seen. Every other time, they swab the cheek. They never are pulling people's hair out. They're always swabbing their cheek to get DNA. So the only reason that Jim Brass took her hair was, I mean, that Grissom took her hair was that to give Jim Brass his moment of being able to be like, oh, yep, nope. Like,
she's not. Didn't he ask if she was a blonde before he even took the hair?
I don't remember.
No. And, well, yeah, I think that was the order of operations. But yeah, he pulls it out. He pulls it by the root because he says he needs the DNA or whatever.
Yeah. You need
you're
that.
Absolutely
you need
right. If he was only looking for a DNA, he could have just
swapped your cheek.
There was a very cheeky moment with the, I didn't send me your DNA. Oh, how would you like it?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, and it's like, it's kind of a fun scene in the sense that, like, Grissom, like, it's like your Jedi mind tricks won't work on me.
Yeah. Grissom's like, this.
Like, nope. Like, your seduction and then sort of like leaving Brass out to dry when he leaves the room, you know?
Yeah. He's like, oh, I'm sure Jim Brass won't mind showing you, and just walks out. I'm like, Grissom, and don't do like, that to like, your butt.
Get him wrapped around your finger in here.
We have a short scene of Doc Robbins processing. We then have Grissom listening to opera on the headphones. Doc Robin enters. We learn, this is where we learn that the spider bite, aka wound of unknown origin, is actually from an injector, which is used to, people use to like dose themselves with insulin. So if they're diabetic, they like can use this injector to give themselves insulin. But the victim, not diabetic. So this is a problem.
This is why the sight thing is so weird, is like the number of people who are injecting themselves with insulin on a regular basis, they're not walking around these giant spider bite marks. No,
that's what I was like. And was it just like maybe the idea is that, you know, we already know at this point that somebody else did, or we assume at this point that somebody else did the injecting. Maybe it's like the force that they used was like way more than you should if you were like self-injecting.
This is the one where there wasn't even a needle. It's the,
they're not a needle, no.
Yeah, it's like it's just the power of the spray.
Yeah.
The one thing I was thinking was like maybe they just have no idea and injected too much. But a lot of times I was like auto injectors, you can't even do that much more than a normal dose. And, you know, not for nothing, most people who are diabetic, the amount of insulin they're putting in their body, it's really not safe. Like they're doing it, you know, they do, I don't know, there's different amounts, but like even if you did like the maximum amount, like it's not that far from their normal dose, right? And like I just think they needed a mark.
So yeah, they needed a mark. Yeah, they needed a mark to bring attention to it.
I would love to know, like, is this a thing? Because it just seems so disassociated. Like, you could have done the same thing with like, oh, there's this weird mark. Like, oh, maybe he was a drug user. Maybe he's this. I said, oh, yeah, we'll do a thing anyways. Yeah. And then come back and have it be insulin and be like, oh, that's weird.
Yeah, like that's
they
strange.
Made it this really big thing. Maybe they had the skin slicing scene with Doc Robbins.
Yeah, this was right before that. He was doing the processing.
Oh, yeah. And so I guess it makes good TV, but like it was like, there's no way. Like, there's no, like even if you use a high dose of insulin, I don't think it would look like that. I think it would just get absorbed in your bloodstream and you'd, presumably that is going to kill you by dropping your blood sugar to near zero. Although I'm sure there's a lot of other weird things that happen when you do that.
I'm sure. So we leave this storyline. We leave the storyline. We go with Catherine and Nick. They're at a scene. Catherine keeps getting calls from Eddie, but they're coming in static. She can't really like hear anything. She's like, hey, you need to like get to a better line. And then
she's on a cell phone too, and she hasn't once considered the problem.
No, it's not her problem.
I guess you could tell that he's calling from his cell phone because at this point we have caller ID, but
yeah,
it was kind of interesting.
Yeah. But we learn that this scene is an example of Dunn's dead upstairs neighbor syndrome. Catherine is searching the apartment. She finds like a well-populated passport, a bunch of cash. So they're starting to think that like maybe this victim is a drug dealer and the death was not like due to like an exercise mishap. Then Catherine gets another call. It's Lindsay on the line and she's saying that she's scared and she's all alone. Yeah. So Catherine, understandably, pieces out, leaves the scene. She is then driving. She's talking to Lindsay. And Lindsay says in this exchange that, you know, she's talking about water and wet. And then, so Catherine thinks like she's like near a lake or in a lake or something. And she's like, no, the water is in the car, which obviously really upsets Catherine. And I will say, I have to give the actor who plays Lindsay credit. I mean, I think that Marge did a great job in the scene as well. This got me emotional both times I watched the scene.
Oh yeah,
like it like legitimately upset me.
It felt very realistic. Both, yes, like the panic and the talking and the crack, the voice, though, it just sounded exactly like the way kids sound in those types of situations.
I was watching this the first time on a plane, and I was getting emotional, and I was like, the person next to me is going to like be concerned about me.
I mentioned this in the Vegas score review, but like they've been showing all these scenes of it raining, right?
Yes.
Up to this scene, like it's been downpouring in Vegas, which does not get a lot of rain. And half an inch of rain in Vegas is an insane amount of rain.
It's an insane amount of rain. It can cause flooding very easily.
Yeah, the there dust is not silt makes it like ice. Like it's like driving on black ice out there. And so, yeah, that's not something people outside of like the Southwest know very well, but like it actually makes very dangerous driving conditions in general. And so, but the other thing, and this is supposed to be important, is like you have to figure out how to deal with all that water because the soil does not absorb it.
Nope.
The strip has got a lot of concrete and so very impermeable. So they do a number of different things. If you've ever seen the LA River, you know, they usually end up with these concrete basins where they divert all the water to storm things to get it away from the city.
Yeah. So Catherine is talking to Lindsay. She's trying to figure out where they were going. She's trying to like narrow down her field of search. So she's asking her if they passed any hotels and things of that nature. Catherine realizes she's probably on this one road called Industrial Road. So Catherine gets there. She finds a broken fence. She looks down. She spots Eddie's car in the water. She sees Lindsay. She immediately grabs a tool from her car. She, you know, just slides down the, I want to call it an embankment, but it's not an embankment. Yeah. Like concrete embankment.
Yeah. So it's a storm wash or whatever you call it. But it's a slanted 45 degree, usually concrete sides so that to hold the water in.
Yeah. So she slides down that. She's trying to get Lindsay to move away to go to like the front of the car so she can smash the window and pull her out. Lindsay is terrified, doesn't want to move. So then Catherine goes around the car. She dives underneath. She smashes the window, grabs Lindsay and pulls her up. Again, I just want to point out this whole scene made me very emotional. So kudos, CSI, because this entire scene made me very emotional.
This tool for breaking the window is one of those things that almost everybody should have in their car.
Yes, and you should.
Myself included, do not.
I do not.
Most people do not. They are like hardened, tipped things because glass is tempered in vehicles so that it's less likely to cut you. And that's why she doesn't want to smash the window in front of Lindsay. She doesn't want her to get cut.
Yeah.
Is it breaks really easily when you put something really hard against it. And so you probably could not punch a car window.
No.
Certainly without like even footing on the ground. But one of these tools, you just like, it's like popping bubble pop. Like you just start pushing it, all of a sudden it just goes pop and the glass breaks into thousands of little pieces. And so, if you're like in a situation where you'd be trapped in a car, and I have been upside down in a car before and been like, how do I get out of this thing?
Yeah. Like how
doors don't work right anymore.
Yeah.
Fortunately, the windows were already blown out. And
so, so you're like, well,
you crawl on the glass on the floor and,
fun.
And get up. But it was, so it's one of those things. And she obviously has it like a first aid kit. It looks like she's a super prepared kit in the back of her car.
Yeah.
Which is like a first aid kit, flares, the whole nine yards. I have a sleeping bag because I live in the Northeast and
I don't even have that. I have literally nothing in my car. If something happened to me, I would not be prepared at all. I have nothing in my car. I have a Gatorade, so I guess I would have some hydration for a bit.
Yeah.
That's about it. That's all I got. So then Catherine and Lindsay are with Detective Vega, and we're hearing from Lindsay that a lady was driving the car. She had pink hair, and that her father had a stomach ache. At the same time that this is happening, the car is, you know, being pulled up from this like storm draining system. Sarah is there. Both Catherine and Sarah are in the car. Catherine finds drugs in the car. Sarah is very quick to point out that Catherine should not be handling any evidence because she's not on the case.
Yeah.
So Sarah's essentially telling her, let me do my job. Like, you shouldn't be involved in this. You're not on the case.
Is it like also like very true that the level of conflict of interest here?
Oh, is extreme.
Yeah. Like, you shouldn't be, you just can't be involved in cases.
This is your ex. Who reported you to child services.
Yes.
And now he's no longer here. Well, we'll learn that in a bit. But this is a dicey situation for him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you just shouldn't be. We just had an episode with Warwick where we learned that getting involved, like being working cases that you are personally involved in, doesn't end well for anybody. It ends really, really poorly. So stop getting involved in personal cases.
We had it with Nick.
Yep.
We've had it with Warwick. We've now had it with Catherine.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think we've ever had it with Grissom, although.
No, Grissom's made some stupid mistakes, but yeah. I don't think any of them were. But I mean, we'll get there in this episode.
Yeah, but I do want to say that. I was like, we're kind of halfway there in this episode, I guess.
We're going to get there.
Sarah, I mean, other than the fact that her boyfriend is an ambulance driver, it has not really come up.
Yeah, like she has gotten very personally invested in cases, but she wasn't personally involved with the people that were in the cases. It was just like the subject of the case was very personal for her.
Warwick's done it a couple times now too, because there was that kid. They kind of like lost that storyline, who the kid he was in the hospital was visiting or spending time with.
Yeah. So then we have Doc Robbins scanning Nick's victim. Nick enters. They end up, well, Doc Robbins ends up extracting a tip of a needle from their victim. And then Jim Brass is with Grissom. Trey had two hotel rooms in one night. So, like, that's weird. Like, why would you have two hotel rooms registered under your name for the same night? Which brings Grissom and Warwick entering a hotel room.
Oh, yeah.
There is a woman waiting. We learn that her name is Rebecca McCormick. And she is waiting for a sex worker, a male sex worker. And claims that this is the first time she's ever done anything like this. And she's very flustered. And we'll come back to Rebecca. I thought
this was your spot, the guest star, because your person looks very familiar to me, and I never place them.
She is not. She should be, because she is in 4 episodes of a TV show that I watched last year, but I don't remember her from that show. So I'm just not going to claim that I remember her, because I'm like, I don't remember her from that show. So she is not my spot, the guest star, but she should technically be. We then have Nick on a computer, Gross Mentors. Nick has cracked the appointment book of his victim, Croy Richards. And this is where we connect the dots and realize that both victims were sex workers. They refer to them as gigolos. I'm not going to call them gigolos. I'm going to call them sex workers. And Grissom thinks that they're working the same case, that like insulin was probably involved in both. We can't prove it with Croy because of the decomp, but that needle is a gauge appropriate for administering insulin.
I think the other thing they mentioned, like lifelong or regular insulin users, because smaller gauge needles, just they leave less marks. They are less, they can be less painful. And if you're doing it multiple times a day, every day,
yeah,
that starts to add up.
Of course it does. Yeah, for sure. Jim Brass and Grissom are then at, oh, and we also got employment history on Croy Richards. And there's a bit of a look exchange between Nick and Grissom where no words are said, but something's up. Which brings us to Jim Brass and Grissom at Lady Heather's. She's saying it's nice to see them again. Like, she's happy to see them. She tells them that both of the victims were on her payroll. And we have a nice little callback. Jim Brass mentions that Mona Taylor, one of her employees, died last year. And I was like, nice callback, CSI. And we learn that they're independent contractors. But, you know, Jim Brass and Grissom want to see, like, what they did. And so we get a nice little walkthrough of the dungeon with Nine Inch Nails playing in the background. And the same, again, this could very well be the exact same pool.
No, I was like, this is like, this has to be the same set.
Yep. Oh, I meant to do this earlier. So then we learn that both victims worked like via cam. They were dominating people via cam at Lady Heather Duck.
My dominion is also my domain. Lady Heather Duck.
So Buckman and Richards were down here doing internet porn.
Come on, I'm going to do it right now. I meant to open up ladyheather.com earlier today to see if it does. It brings you, it redirects you to Paramount Plus CSI. Okay.
So originally it redirected you to the CSI website.
Yeah, that
was in the notes for the episode at the bottom of the IMDb like trivia
that
thing.
That is so funny. So now it redirects you to paramountplus.com/shows/CSI. That's so funny.
I should just bookmark ladyheathers.com.
Yeah, and then it'll just bring you to the
episode for the podcast. So just go to that, and then if they ever lose that website, I'll be surprised.
So as I continue to talk to Lady Heather, she is asking Grissom why he keeps staring at her lips. And Grissom's response is that she has lovely lips.
Yep.
And Jim Brass is like, okay, then. Like, let's talk about case.
I mean, so, Jim Brass, first off, there's no
right. You just got caught
right.
Looking up a woman's dress.
No right.
He has no right.
Taking the high ground.
No, here. He does not.
He gave that away. Between fatal and attraction.
I will say, and I don't think that this gives away, I don't think this is a spoiler alert. Jim Brass has so many great, like, short comedic moments in this episode.
Punchy.
He's great in this episode. Like, almost every time that he's on screen, I'm like, I'm for this.
This is a really good Jim Brass episode.
It was a very good Jim Brass episode. We're then with Catherine Vega, Sarah, and Lindsay. They're in a room talking. Catherine is, and I guess, I don't know how I feel about this, because I feel, in some ways, Catherine would be more protective of Lindsay, but she's very pushy in this scene. She keeps kind of interrupting, and as Lindsay's talking, being like, no, you can remember more than that. You know?
She's doing the thing like a parent do to their kids in not this level of serious situations, right? If you just think of normal, like when you're talking to a teacher, you're talking to another loved one, you know, where she's not treating her daughter like a witness, she's treating her daughter as her daughter.
Yeah.
And she's also like, again, her emotional investment in the situation is sort of clouding her
judgment.
Her judgment, yeah. Like clouding her normal demure.
Yeah. And so throughout this scene where they're in this room talking, we're getting intercut scenes of men searching the storm drain area. So we're cutting between these two different scenes. Then Lindsay is talking about how, you know, she woke up at a building, that her dad had a meeting there. And again, Catherine is very emotionally invested and probably in some level of emotional turmoil at this time. So Sarah takes Catherine out of the room. Vega, Sarah, and Lindsay continue to talk. We get a flashback of the building, of, you know, them arriving to the building, this woman coming out of the building, Eddie greeting her, them, you know, things like that. Catherine gets a call, and I will also say I think this episode does this really well. Well, we see Eddie, like, just lying face down. The men find him, he's just lying face down. Catherine gets a call, her face drops, she's looking at her daughter. I'm glad that the episode wasn't super, super heavy-handed with this. We know that Eddie's dead, right? Like, we don't need to hear on the other line, like, sorry, we found Eddie and he's dead, right? We have enough context clues to know that Eddie is dead.
So this is a very powerful scene for me. This is probably a pretty personal note, but like, so listeners probably are not going to know this, but my mother died when I was very young. And I came home with my brother, and my parents had been separated. my mom's neighbor was outside and like had never been to my father's house before. That was weird. And there were just two gentlemen who were in there talking to my dad, and we were being kept outside. And then we were like, what are we on dinner? And I remember it took a while. And at some point my dad had to tell us that our mom was dead. And I just think like, I always think about that moment as being the first of many impossible tasks in single parenthood for my dad.
Right.
Which is that like, I have to tell my kids who I love that the only other person besides me that, you know, they love to the end of the universe
is no longer
is gone.
Yeah.
While also trying to figure out how I'm going to be a single parent for the rest of my life.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, and how I'm going to deal with the current needs and the future needs. It's just like that moment is just like, you're just going to do one thing at a time. But it's like that devastation. I think the actress did a great job. And the scene, it felt, I think as somebody with a personal experience, it felt like, I'm glad they didn't like make a big deal of it.
Yes.
But I agree. If you have any context for that experience, I think that you felt it. And to do that, I think is like really hard. Like to like make the moment good enough for the people to whom it matters a little extra.
Yeah.
But like not make it a bump on the road.
Yeah.
For all the other viewers. Instead, for them, they understand the importance in the situation, but we don't have to like spend 20 minutes here.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And move forward. So I could not, I was like, first time I watched that one, I was like, that was really good. I cannot believe that I felt something in that moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like acutely, like I knew what was going on and could connect to it.
Yeah.
And it seemed like it was a good amount for a normal viewer. And I went, that's really hard. It's hard to do that.
Yeah, to balance those two things.
For everybody.
Yeah.
And then still make the people who like, you know something or experience something feel like, yeah, that's kind of exactly what it's like.
Yeah. I do not have that experience. So I will not comment on that side of it. But as a, I guess, standard viewer, I thought it was a very well done scene.
And it's actually really interesting because I think this is going to color my view of this episode quite a bit when we get to the end. But I don't want to talk any more about that because it really sort of spoils the rest of the storyline.
We're with Catherine. She's with Eddie's body. Doc Robbins gently tells her that this is not where you should say goodbye to someone. Like, you shouldn't say goodbye to somebody in an autopsy room. This is not the time or the place for that. So then Catherine's in the hallway. She finds Grissom. They talk cases. Grissom, as socially inept as he can be sometimes, is like, hey, do you need time? I'm really sorry about Eddie and your daughter. And she responds that we're okay. We're going to come back around to this, listeners.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to come back around to this.
This is the first part of like a couple of scenes that sort of paint an interesting story here. But she gives this sort of impression that she's ready to get back to work.
Yeah, she just wants to get back to work.
Distraction, right?
Yeah. So we learn that the victims died approximately 4 weeks apart, and they're looking through credit card transactions from Lady Heather's websites. They decide to narrow it only to like Las Vegas residents, because if it was 4 weeks apart, it's probably not somebody who flew in to do the murder, right? It's probably somebody local. And then we see Sarah's coming down the hallway. They're in a room. Sarah's coming down the hallway with a tech. We learned that the drug was GHB, but it would like, but if I guess as someone who really has never used recreational drugs, I don't know, but I guess like mixed with meth, it makes a fun party drug according to this tech. And so that's probably like what was going on with the woman who was taking it.
I feel like GHB was a big deal at this time. I mean, it's still a big deal.
It's still a big deal for sure.
Like it's still
a concern. Like it's still a concern,
but it was in the forefront of people's thoughts. There were a lot of news stories, late night news stories, references in pop culture. And the number of like random ways they refer to this drug through this episode.
Oh yeah. Like, it's weird.
What, I don't know.
Yeah.
It was weird.
Yeah. So there's kind of following up on the we're okay notice. Catherine looks at Sarah in a very particular way in this scene. Because she knows that Sarah's working on Eddie's case. And so she gives a look and then she kind of shakes it off. She gets back to work. Grissom is saying, as they're going through the Las Vegas residence, that they should exclude anyone with light hair because of the dark hair that was found. And then look at who's on the list. Our lovely lady Rebecca from the hotel room. So
there's this is the scene with Nick and Warwick, right?
Yes.
And so I just want to take a second to call out that after having this real, like, I don't want to talk about it, let's just get back to work moment with Grissom.
Yeah.
When she goes in, Nick and Warwick are like, how are you doing? And she has a much more normal, let me open myself up a little bit to you.
Yeah.
Which I think is a really great way of highlighting that in these moments, like, even though Grissom's trying.
Yes.
Because he just, like, the people in his life don't feel like they can be emotionally vulnerable around him, which is, I think, in a lot of ways, like, gut-wrenching. That's what I, you know, when I hear this, think. So that, I think, was a really good scene. Again, they just laced it in and kept the tempo going. So that was pretty well done.
Yeah. So this brings Grissom and Catherine to a very nice home. We see a man and Rebecca approaching them. We learn that, you know, they're husband and wife, and that he hired Croy to dominate Rebecca, and that the sessions were held at Lady Heather's. And the husband is very curious about who Trey is, because he doesn't know who Trey is. He only knows Croy. And he's also very surprised to hear that his wife had booked a night at the Tangiers, because he was supposed to be there for all the sessions with Croy. So
they do some very interesting things in the scene to play into this, like, dominant submissive thing.
Yes.
Like, they do some things very,
very subtly.
Yeah, subtly and accurately, but then they also mess it up a bunch at the same time.
Yeah.
But it's like, clearly somebody did a little bit of research.
Yes.
And then they gave a little bit of direction in a couple of scenes, and then it did not make, that information did not make it to the editor's room.
No, didn't quite translate all the way there. We're then with Sarah. She's examining Eddie's car. She finds a printout, and this is my second spot. The guest star.
Oh, yeah.
So this is Polly Perrette, who plays Candice in this episode. And I know her, and I think a lot of you will probably know her, primarily as Abby Shuto from NCIS. Because she's in 354 episodes of that show.
Oh, you know what? It's so funny. I learned this when I looked it up, and I totally forgot about it on the second watch through, because I don't think she looks so different in my mind to what that character looks like.
Yeah.
But I've never watched that show.
Oh, see, I have. Yeah.
But there are some legit old school memes from her character in that show.
Oh, I'm sure there are. But it also includes the
greatest scene of all time, in which two people use the same keyboard to hack a computer twice as fast.
Not how it works, my friends.
It's absolutely hilarious. But yeah, I've never watched the show, but I've seen it. And a very, like, I feel like this character was in, like, commercials for this show every single
time. She was. She was a good, like, she was
very
a
very recognizable character.
She was a very beloved character on the show, and became, like, I don't think originally they expected the audience to love her as much as they did, and she became a very, like, critical part of the show. Sarah also pulls a CD from the CD player from the car, which brings Sarah and DeVega to a recording studio. And we see a flashback of Candice throwing a fit. She wants, you know, she needs Eddie there. She's begging Eddie to show up. And we learn that the people working at the studio kept recording after Candice left. So Vega and Sarah are gonna want copies of that tape.
Yeah. You can basically, they do a couple things to let you know that, like, you can basically hear stuff going on outside the recording studio inside.
Yeah.
So
yeah. So that's why they went the recording, because they're like, okay, well, maybe it picked up the crime or some, you know, some other key pieces of evidence. We're then with Warwick, he's comparing hairs. Catherine and Grissom are there as well. And I appreciated the scene in the fact that he didn't definitively say they were a match. He said that it was consistent. The hairs are consistent. And I was like, good. Because there's, like, no exact, unless you can DNA match them, there's no way to exactly match hairs.
Yeah, that's what he says at the end. Like, if we have DNA, obviously we can prove it. But he also, like, we've never had somebody walk us through what they're looking for. And he goes through like three different things. Like this matches this, this, that matches it, this matches that.
Yeah.
And it's like, or for like the time or like the color and like all these things. I was like, oh, we got some real good forensic information here, which it's been a long time.
It's been a while.
Since they really delved into what they're doing when they're doing these tests. Yeah. And so I really like that. But yeah, I also agree. Like he's like, listen, this gets us this far. It's almost certainly her. And then I think they... Oh, no. Yeah. Eventually they do the DNA part.
Yes.
Or later. But
later on, they get a sample from something else that provides DNA.
But it gives them a lot of, you know, whereas they have been very quick to, you know, accuse people of being guilty, not just in this episode, but in recent episodes.
Yep.
It gives them a lot more confidence, I think, when they're going to the interrogation.
Yep. Agreed. We're then with Chris and with Lady Heather. They're talking about Steven and his wife. And I guess Steven was an investor in Lady Heather's site, and Lady Heather's talking about working through them, and that really what he was trying to say, Steven was trying to say, that it was an issue with his wife, but really the fault was in himself, and he accidentally opened a Pandora's box by expanding, you know, the sexual universe for his wife. Grissom points out, which will become very important as we continue, that the submissive is the one that has the power, and it seems like Steven doesn't quite get that concept.
This is a line that's supposed to be like really powerful.
Yeah.
And then the problem is they use it more than once in the episode.
They use it more than
I feel like it loses its teeth a little bit.
Yeah. It comes, it will come back around to it.
But yeah, obviously, I think it, you know, you anything that happens among sane adults is consensual first. And so, you know, anyone can walk away at any time, both sides of the dynamic. So,
yes.
Realistically, it's more that the submissive person maintains all of that power, no matter what you have convinced yourself the situation is. They're a free human being,
yeah,
and they can leave at any time. But also, like it happens the other way too.
Yeah. And then the mood shifts a little bit. Lady Heather gets a little bit close. She asks Grissom if he's losing his hearing. He says that he's losing his balance. And then he puts his hands on her face. And then there's an exchange of like, you could always say stop before we sort of like pan away and are left to like deduce what happens.
I don't know how they got here. I feel like they skipped a level, but this moment is like really intense between two people that I was like, it didn't really, we went from like a 3 to like a 9, you know, the intensity scale.
Yeah.
And it's like, Grissom, like would take her out to dinner first or something. Like where is this coming from? Like did we miss? Like I felt like we missed a scene or something, which is harder than a 90-minute episode with 37 minutes of Vegas or 37 seconds.
That's 6 seconds. There wouldn't be a lot of content if there was 37 minutes of Vegas.
It's still be scene. Another 28 minutes to.
That's film, true. You know? That is true. We're then with Sarah and Vega. They're with Candice. Catherine is listening though, and she initially is denying that she saw Eddie. She finally caves and she's claiming that she tried to get Eddie out of the car, but the kid kept screaming and, you know, she's just one person. Like, what do you want me to do? Catherine enters and literally says, I will kill you.
Yep.
Like, I will kill you. I will put you in the ground. So Sarah and Catherine are then in the hallway and Catherine is essentially saying to Sarah that she's not doing her job. Sarah, I think this was another well-acted scene on both sides. Catherine is heated and lashing out, and you know, as someone, you know, I've never been in this specific incident, but I've been in incidents is where I've been very hurt and I want answers.
Yeah.
And maybe sometimes I direct that like anger and that like frustration at the wrong person. And that's what is happening in this scene. Sarah keeps her composure. She's upset. Like, you can tell that she's upset, but she keeps her composure. And she tells Catherine that, you know, in a way, understandably, wants revenge right now.
Yeah.
But, like, that's not what we're here to do. And that Catherine really should go home and be with her daughter. Like, her daughter is the one that needs her right now. You shouldn't be here. You should be at home with your daughter.
Also, I know Grissom was like, oh, do you need any time off? But, like,
he didn't push it really hard.
He needs to really be checking in and picking up on these things and sending her home.
Yep. Yep, which, spoiler alert, doesn't happen. We then have a very abrupt change of scene with Grissom and Lady Heather enjoying some tea. In this like lovely little exchange that they're having, we learn that Lady Heather is a diabetic, type 1, and she uses a pressure syringe to take her insulin, which sours the mood immediately, and Grissom needs a warrant, so he calls in and asks for a warrant for Lady Heather's paraphernalia.
She's like, "Do you want to see it?" And he's like, "Yes, but I'll need a warrant."
But I'll need a warrant. Yeah.
Which
is his way of saying stop.
It's very interesting because obviously, I think as an audience member, and you're supposed to assume that he's now considering her a suspect. Mm-hmm. And it's important because that's the reference to say, like, now, oh, so now I'll take that as meaning stop, right? As he's not. It's offensive to her that, I think rightfully, given the facts, the inevitable facts, that he's considering her a suspect.
Yeah.
That he wants to make sure that he obtains this with a warrant, that he, you know, he's trying to follow the right moves. Now, it is important that he would, there are other versions of this show, other episodes, where in this situation, you might say something along the lines of like, oh, so like two of the people died, they did this or whatever. I was like, would you be willing to let us test your, stuff, and instead he just goes, even though you've literally already asked to let me look at it, instead of like asking if you're willing to turn it over to the police, I'm going to call and get a warrant and assume that the answer is no.
Yeah.
And which really puts him on the offensive and forces her to the defensive. And that's the real misstep in this relationship. And I think it's important because, you know, it's a big part of the plot of the episode is that they have definitely done this with other people. Like the lady with the jacket last time, they jumped through some loopholes, but like to get it. But like, you know, they've asked people for evidence just as matter of fact. And people who aren't guilty or, you know, they might just be like, yes. Or she could have said, you need a warrant, that would have been fine. Like, I think this scene would have been even better for I almost assume it's intentional, but like, I assume like a normal, like the scene would have worked just as well if he was like, I would like to see it, but I need to ask if I can take it as evidence. And she said, well, you know that I have a policy that I wouldn't let that happen without a warrant. He said, and he was like, yep, I think I'm going to have to get a warrant. And then they had all the whole rest of it. And while that would have been longer, it would have like maintained that. But I think you're supposed to, like, it's designed to make Grissom all of a sudden put down this personal life thing that he's enjoying and put it aside completely to then become obsessive about his work again. Right.
Yeah. I think I interpret this as soon as Grissom has an out, or as soon as Grissom has a way to put up a wall, he takes it.
That's a good point.
Like as soon as there's an inkling of something, he's like, oh, yep, nope, I can put my walls back up. Because I say that based primarily on a later scene. Like, I don't know if I would have quite gotten there entirely with this scene alone, but in a scene that we'll get to shortly, I think it is very much reiterated that's
a good take too.
That is kind of like,
yeah, people are like that, right? Like, they've convinced themselves to finally get out of their shell, but you know, as soon as they have the ability, they're looking for any excuse to get out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, that's how I viewed it. We're then with Jim Brass with Rebecca/Mrs. McCormick. Warwick is there in the room as well. We learn that the DNA under the sheet is hers and that 2 months ago she withdrew $500K, which is like exactly the same amount that was in Croy's apartment.
I think it was $50,000.
Yep. And
yeah,
she's like, well, Croy wasn't even worth that much, but he's better than my husband. And was like, oh snap, Mrs. McCormick.
That relationship was doomed for failure.
But it was doomed for failure. It doesn't have a lot of good signs. Sarah's in with Archie and they're going over the audio file. They isolate what they assume is the gunshot as well as an engine, which probably, or Archie believes, might belong to an Harley. Vega enters and conveniently Candy's called Eddie a whole bunch of times, but her last call was to somebody else. Dun. Vega is then with this guy. Sarah's doing some swabbing. He's on parole, we find. At first, he's claiming that he does not know Candice and, like, whatever. Yeah, like, some sexy, voiced woman called him. But, like, whatever. No big deal. But then, look at that. His garage, or part of his garage, tested positive for GHB.
Yeah, there was, like, a broken vial, or he tried to dump some or something.
Yeah, yeah. And
I think maybe you're supposed to think, like, he heard, like, the cops pulling up or something.
Yeah.
And like, tried to get rid of his stash.
Get rid of it. Yeah. And so then he starts changing his tune a bit, and he's saying that Candy needed help. And, you know, he gets there, and we see a flashback in which Candy shoots Eddie. So they take him in. They cuff him. Jim Brass is then interrogating Lady Heather. And she's saying that she can, as I said in the end of the last episode, I just love Lady Heather. Like, I didn't remember this specific episode until I started watching it. And then I was like, oh, right, this episode. She just, you know, she's a confident woman. And I like that about her. She's like, I can help you with your inadequacies to Jim Brass. Again, this is such a good Jim Brass episode. He just rolls with it. Like, yeah. He just is like, whatever. He's like letting it, like, roll right off of him. He's like a duck in water.
So, you know what really gets me going?
The truth.
It's probably a top 10 scene of CSI, I think, of all time, is this, because there's this interplay. You get Jim Brass doing his thing.
Yeah.
And Heather doing her thing. And she's talking to Grissom through the class.
Yes.
Playing off as those. Brass is foolishly not quite understanding.
He's not. He thinks. So, in Lady Heather walks over to one of the like glass panes, where Grissom is right on the other side.
We get this
split where Grissom can see Lady Heather as she's talking, and she is talking, and she's very poignantly talking to Grissom. But Jim Brass thinks that she's still talking to him, so he keeps being like, Hart doesn't really have anything to do with it. Like, I don't, yeah. Like, that's weird. This is more about the fact that you murdered two people. Like, I don't know. Like, but it's a great scene. And this is the moment where, if I didn't realize it in the scene previously, she tells Grissom that she's disappointed in him and that he fears her because she knows him.
Yep.
And this is where I think that the war, how he went about handling the fact that she's diabetic and she has insulin and he, you know, needs to see her supplies, was just like a, oh good, now I have an out. Now I can put that wall back up again and not be connected to somebody that actually knows me. This was a fantastic scene. Like, this was such a good scene. And Melinda Clark, mwah, chef's kiss. Such a good job in this. We're then with Grissom. He's examining like an injector and an insulin. And as he's looking at the bottles of insulin, one of them has like a little bit less in it. So he brings both the injector and the insulin bottle to Greg Sanders. And he's like, you need to process this ASAP. Catherine and Grissom are then back at the home of Stephen and Rebecca. And Rebecca dead. Rebecca strangled to death.
She's just dead on the middle of the stairs. She's
dead in the middle of the stairs. Yep.
Hubby over in the corner drinking a tall glass of milk.
Yeah, just hanging out. And he, you know, admits that he found her on the stairs. Catherine examines his hands. And she is very surprised, but he is not, that he didn't touch his wife.
No.
Like, he walked over, looked, was like, well, she's dead, and called authorities. And he doesn't seem to find anything strange about the fact that he didn't feel the need to touch his wife.
They never say this, but I assume he was there.
Yeah, they never say it, but there's definitely a chance that he was there. And another important component of the scene is that Grissom finds a fiber in the wound. So he pulls a fiber from the wound. Vega and Sarah are then with Candice. She's now pointing the finger at the biker guy, the parolee, and saying, and we get a flashback in which he shot Eddie. Yeah.
There's something else in this scene that I think is well done and powerful. It was kind of hard. I didn't want to jump to it earlier on the episode, but she's singing in the booth, the music that night.
Yeah.
Eddie's obviously not there because he's at his daughter's recital.
Yes.
She's having a hard time.
Yes.
And she's used to leaning on him for support.
Yeah.
He's not there. He's not answering. She's turning back to drugs is what she's actually. She's not calling her ex-boyfriend guy. She's calling
the dealer,
the guy she can get drugs from.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing that she needs to get over her nerves or where she's convinced herself to do it.
Yeah.
And so she's sort of like, it's this thing that comes up a lot where with people who are struggling is that when their safety nets aren't around, it's the hardest it'll ever be.
Yeah.
And it, they don't pull it out. They don't like overanalyze it. They don't force it, but they are telling you that story in the background in a way that's, again, just the writing in this episode is very good. It's very strong. And it, these kind of moments are like, oh man, what a great, like, especially in the second watch through, I pick up on more of this stuff because it's like, I'm not paying attention to some of the other things. And it's like, oh yeah, right. She called this guy on her, after calling, she tried to call the person she's supposed to call. She tried to call the person she's supposed to call.
Yeah.
And that's why in like AA, you have sponsors. You need to have a, like,
yeah, someone to like rely on.
You can
on.
Call when you are, when you just need having to talk to a person instead of turning to a substance.
Yeah.
And he's not there. He's not there. Very valid reason, I guess. But when, and he does eventually show up, obviously, but presumably she calls this, I forget his name already, the,
I don't think they ever like say his name in the episode.
Yeah. And so,
or Justin, because, I think maybe. Yeah. I think at some point they call him Justin. I think maybe
they say it very quickly. I think Vegas says it once. But yeah. So that was a cool scene. There really, I mean, what you're getting here is this like he said, she said moment, you know, who, what really happened, we don't really know. And that's important. But I think it's also like for this storyline to say it's like, you know, the Eddie and this Candice, they had a relationship and, you know, he had a lot of hopes in her and got her, getting her sober was part of that. And she was really struggling and probably a lot of pressure, was feeling a lot of pressure because they were recording the single and he's not there. So inevitably she turns to her old vice. And then that sort of leads to this. We actually don't, not to get ahead of it, we never really know the answer to what happens in that moment. But yeah, it was kind of really well done. I liked that. I just wanted to call that out. I didn't want to, like, as those little moments were happening early in the story, I didn't want to jump ahead. So
yeah.
But I really appreciated that, particularly on the second watch through. Those are the kind of things that tend to make second watch throughs.
Yeah.
Really good. Really fun.
Yeah. Really enjoyable. Yeah. So then we have a Grissom and Jibrass walk and talk. We learned that the fiber that was pulled from Rebecca's like strangulation wound was nylon with ostrich feather. So then, again, Jibrass is just so good in this episode. Grissom, at first we just see Grissom back at Lady Heather's.
Yep.
And then Jibrass like pops his head into the door frame and is like, we don't have a warrant.
He's like, what's the magic word? Word? He's like, warrant? He busts that. He's like, warrant? We don't have one.
We don't have one. So good. So good. I was like, Jibrass, you were like, mwah, chef's kiss in this episode. And so they are interested in Chloe Sams, who's a submissive that worked at Lady Heather's. And come to find out, her boots smell like strawberries. So that's a little dicey. And she quit yesterday. So
that's a little bit more dicey.
And so Jibrass leaves because he's like, all right, if she's in the area, like, I'm gonna find her, we gotta track her down. So he leaves. Grissom has a moment with Lady Heather in that he's saying, you know, I know I need to apologize. And Lady Heather, again, I love this character, is like, apologies are just words.
Yep.
Like, buddy, okay,
saying sorry doesn't
fix,
don't not say sorry, but saying sorry does not itself make it better,
right? So then Catherine confronts Sarah. Again, she's having this turmoil that she hasn't herself accepted yet, and she's still directing her anger at Sarah because Sarah is a target that she can reach, right? Like, she can get to Sarah. And Sarah's, again, holding her ground, but being empathetic, and I think is honestly upset that she can't determine who killed Eddie because all she has is two liars and no murder weapon.
Yep.
Justin is saying that Candice shot him. Candice is saying Justin shot him. There's no murder weapon. They probably didn't test them in time for GSR. And then they were in close enough proximity would they both have tested positive for GSR. Anyway, I'm guessing, you know, they don't spend time on this, but I would imagine that they probably
next day.
Yeah, you know, I probably, again, they don't say this, but Sarah being generally very thorough and, you know, how personal this case is and Vegas on the case, that they probably would have looked to see if, like, they were registered gun owners. You know, like, I'm guessing that both of them came up negative, especially Justin. He was on parole. He's probably not legally allowed to own guns. And she, Catherine, again, is just angry and lashing out, and she's like, oh, well, like, that's a great bedtime story for my for my little, like, to tell my little girl.
I would never categorize Catherine's character as like a control freak or, you know, I mean, no, like, who wants control, but she's definitely, I think,
she's trying to control the situation in where she doesn't have control.
It's a coping mechanism.
It is a coping mechanism. Yeah. Oh, for sure.
Yeah, it's that wanting to go back to work, she wants to take her mind off, but she also like, it's going to be, if I could solve this case, I'll somehow make it better.
Yes,
I can go home and tell my little girl what, you know, what happened. You know, who killed her dad, and so that is really good. This storyline is tough for me because I feel like on one hand, do a wonderful job creating this character moment for Catherine where she can't get the answers, where, you know, she's, you know, you want the audience to sit there and be like, is she going to blame Sarah for this? Right, like, for this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And Sarah has earned her stripes in this show in terms of being a good worker. She's probably the person that Catherine would have chose.
Yes.
To take this case.
Yeah. Right? I mean, we just had the episode where the prosecutor purposely chose Sarah to solve her husband's death.
Oh yeah. I didn't even think of that. That's a great point.
Yeah. They just established that Sarah is like the CSI to go to.
So, but it's such an important character to the baseline of the show. It feels so bad that they didn't solve this.
It does.
Or that they didn't at least spend, it's almost like a secondary plot.
Yeah.
Like this is not the A plot.
This is not the A plot. No.
But it's like they don't show the scene where Sarah gets like 50 cadets and spends 3 hours looking for a gun in a 1 mile radius. Like they do other times and then find it.
Yeah.
Right. They don't do that. So it feels like they're leaving a stone unturned. And I could do one of two things. I can put my faith in the show that maybe the book is not closed on this case and it'll show up in a later episode or season or something and they'll finally solve it, or that it's just there because they needed it to be unsolved to tell this character development story.
That's what I would lean towards.
Yeah, well, you would know the answer.
I can't remember the answer, to be honest with you. So I'm just saying, if I had to pick one of them, one or the other, I would pick that it's done for character development purposes.
Yeah. And so it just, and Sarah's like, you know, they're both going back to jail or they're going to go to jail, but that's not, you know, there's a man who's dead. Right. And
neither are getting charged with murder. They're getting charged with like abandonment of a child and drug possession and things of that nature.
Level of closure, I think, that people are looking for.
Right.
So that was tough. And I don't know. I just wanted to take this moment to call out why it's tough, because I'm gonna have to use it to defend myself later.
That's fair. Okay. But then Greg Sanders with Grissom, we learned that Chloe's DNA was on the injector. So, you know.
Their epithelial on the little thumb thingy of the plunger. Yep.
So then Grissom is with Chloe. Jim Brass is in the room as well. And she took, again, lawyer up, my friends. No lawyer present. She just admits right off the bat that she killed for Steven.
Yeah,
I belong to him. I killed for him. End of story. Done. End of story.
I think having some DNA epithelials like on a plunger from a piece of equipment that's in your boss's office down the hall from where you work all the time, like there's a little thin, and which is why it's great to get a confession.
Yeah,
but yeah, she's very very free giving here.
Yeah, yeah. So then we're with Jim Brass, Grissom, and they're talking to Steven. He admits that he met with Chloe occasionally outside of Lady Heather's. And Jim Brass is very quick to point out that, because Steven keeps trying to say, like, oh, it was my wife's problem. And Jim Brass is like, no, your wife didn't have a problem. She had a problem with you. But, like, she didn't have a problem, like, overall. Like, your wife's problem was with you. And he just keeps repeating that he didn't tell Chloe to do anything. And so Grissom points out that he evidently never learned that the submissive is the one in control, and he couldn't control Chloe, and she just did what she was gonna do.
I think Steven says, like, oh, I told her to stop.
I told her. He says it multiple times. He goes, I told her to stop.
And that's what, like, reinforced my idea. I was like, I think he was there.
There, yeah. Because why would he tell her to stop, like, if he had no knowledge?
I'm giving you a command as your dominant.
As your dominant.
Choking my wife to death.
Yeah, and she's like,
she didn't listen, and she kept doing it, and he watched, and he's like, I think supposed to be a little, realize that he's a little traumatized and sort of like his power has been taken away, where he realizes that he didn't have control, he didn't have power. I'm trying to avoid using the term demasculated because it's not
gender
specific here, but it's that idea is sort of what they're trying to portray. So that's why I get the idea. I even just wanted a character to say it to him.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't. It's like, well, you were there, weren't you? You watched it, didn't you?
Right.
You know, like that would have been, good. That's like one of my very few notes for the writers from my time machine.
Yeah. I was going to say from Nick's time machine. We then go to, we see Lindsay walking down the hall. We can hear Catherine crying. Lindsay goes into her room. She is trying to comfort her mom and she's like, oh, it's okay. You know, like, it's okay, mommy, it's okay. Which again, hit me in the feels pretty hard. I was like,
yeah, oh, also a really hard thing. Like the parent, you're always trying to be the protector. You're always trying to be the adult, right? And so whenever you have this moment where their child is taking care of their parent.
Yeah.
Because Catherine doesn't have anyone else.
Yeah. Right. And I kind of wish that this is where the episode ended, but it does not. We then have a very, very short scene with Grissom like in his car outside of Lady Heather's. And then we go. End.
Which they could have.
I'm saying, as much as I love Lady Heather and I love Lady Heather storylines, I think that they should have ended the episode with the scene with Catherine and Lindsay. And this shouldn't, like, we already know that he wants to apologize to Lady Heather. Like, we already know that that's lingering.
He already tried to apologize.
That's what I mean.
Apologize.
And he's already gotten the, like, words are not enough, aka, like, take action. So, like, we don't, whatever. I get why they did it. Not my preferred choice. I wish that they ended it with Catherine and Lindsay. They didn't. What are you going to do?
Did it because Grissom's the main character.
I mean, true story. At least at this point in the show.
They could have literally had that happen like the scene before.
Yeah, but, you know. So that's the end of the episode. So Nick, what did you think about today's episode?
It was long.
It was a longer than usual episode.
They did a great job with a longer episode, filling it in, not having, they did have 36 seconds of Vegas shots, but that's really not that bad. And they used a bunch of it for plot, which is actually itself quite an accomplishment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Did a lot of amazing things. I was killing myself over. So first off, this is definitely a rewatch. It's a good rewatch. Rewatch this episode more than once. I ended on 4.5 out of 5. And I thought it was really close to maybe being the first one of 5. And it sits weird with me that they couldn't solve Eddie's murder. And I think that's the only reason I didn't give it a 5. There's a few little small things there we mentioned in the episode. You don't have to be perfect to get a 5. But yeah, I hemmed and hawed a little bit. I was like, is this a 4.5 or is this a 5? And I felt like I was left wanting something to be materially different in the episode.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, well, totally subjective. So I'm giving it a 4.5. It's not an objective measurement, folks.
This is true. Yeah. So I also gave it a 4.5.
No, good.
But partially, and so maybe this isn't for, maybe it should be a 5 out of 5. But I was kind of like, is it a perfect episode? I feel like in later seasons, I'll have a better grasp of like a perfect episode. So maybe this should be a 5 out of 5 for me. Because like,
it's easy to think.
This point, this has probably been my favorite episode.
This might be the best episode of one of the best. It's definitely a top 3 across all 3 seasons.
All three seasons. Yeah, this is not just like a great episode for this season. I've said this about an earlier episode, but I feel like this episode has the essence of what I love about CSI, right? Like if I was to be like, let me capture the essence of CSI and put it in a bottle, it would be this. Like this would be an episode that I'd be like, yes. Like it's risque, it's campy, but there's very serious moments and everybody's involved and there's character development. And
is part of the reason why that's done so well because they had more space.
I think so. I think that's part of it. Yeah. They had like a little bit more wiggle room. They had more time.
Do we need to consider that? Or is it like, hey, listen, the episode is the episode. And if big episodes tend to make better episodes, there's nothing we can do about that. They're just better episodes.
Yeah. They're just better episodes. Yeah.
Cause you could probably take other episodes. You could probably make bad big episodes.
Oh, for sure. I guess you could.
They probably put the best of their best. They spent a little bit more time, a little bit more money on it.
Yeah.
Because they're trying to make a splash and it paid off because we're both sitting here saying this might be the best episode so far. Yeah. So let's get a little nerdy with Nick for a second.
Ooh, let's get nerdy with Nick.
Most things you'll hear are like a lot of things in the world get distributed on bell curves, right?
Yes.
Normal distribution. And there's in the middle of your bell curve, maybe like a 2.5 out of 5,
yep.
right?
Yep.
And then you get half of the episodes should be below and half of the episodes would be above.
Yeah.
In theory. And that, but like the bulk of them are going to be really close to 2.5. So they'd be somewhere between 2 and 4.
And like 3.5.
3.5 or something. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, but the way it works out is I think the extreme, what they call 3 standard deviations above the mean, like the really cream to the creme, it's only like 3.5%.
Yeah.
But we've had enough episodes at this point. We've had 50, 60 episodes. Mm-hmm. We're in the middle of, or 60 something episodes. We're in the middle of, so we theoretically should have already hit a 5. So it's not so weird to say, like, on average, like the best episode out of 50 should be a 5.
Right? Yeah.
And so 5's in the thing. And so, yeah, I would encourage you. You're like, oh, if your only reason is like, you're worried about there's a better episode. Yeah. When you get to the end of like 400 episodes, you should have like 20 fives.
Yeah. So maybe this is a 5. Maybe I'm like talking myself out of it. This is a 5.
Yeah. I talked myself out of a five, but for like, and it hurt. And so I'm trying to talk you into a 5 to make myself feel better.
It's a 5. It's a 5 out of it. Literally, again, this is like the essence of CSI. This was a great episode. Yeah. And it was a longer than average episode, but it didn't feel that way. Like, I wasn't like, oh, man, this episode is dragging on forever. Like, this is so long.
It didn't drag.
And even the
But even eventually the you figured out it was longer.
Yeah. And then even the rewatch was, like, great.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is great. This is solid on a rewatch.
My rewatch up, but that had everything to do with walking my dog.
That's fair.
Because it's so long that it was like, oh, this isn't going to be over 5 minutes. Oh, there's still 20 minutes left. Okay, yeah, I'll pause. We'll walk the dogs and then come back. I will say that in many ways, it gives me a little bit of pleasure that the one reason why I don't want to give this a 5, I also think is a very valid, reasonable choice. And it probably makes the episode better for some people, right?
Yeah.
For some people, it's better that Eddie's murder is unsolved and Catherine has. And I get all that tension and whatever, but like, I don't know. I just like, I wanted it to be solved and I wanted there to be good evidence for it.
Yeah. So we'll see. I mean, I feel like the follow-up episode, it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough to like roll into another 4.5 to 5 episode, but who knows? We'll see what we come to when we return next week with season 3, episode 16, Lucky Strike. In the meantime, you can support us on Patreon by searching for Who Are You Calling a CSI Podcast. You can find us on Facebook the same way. We're also on Twitter/X and Instagram at Who Are You CSI Pod. And we also have a website at whoareyoucsipod.com. But otherwise, we will talk to you next week.
No spoilers.
No spoilers.